Peter had never known any emotion so powerful as the emotion that gripped him now. "Get out," he said to the doctor. "Sir?" The man looked startled. "Get out," Peter repeated, "all of you." And he waited until the opaque glass door closed behind them, before he spoke to the girl in conversational tones. "You have made me abandon my own principles and descend to your level." The girl watched him uncertainly. Her eyes flickered to the shot pistol that Peter held dangling from his right hand. "You have forced me, a career soldier, to disobey the orders of a superior officer in the face of the enemy." He paused. "I used to be a proud man. But when I've done what I must do now, I will no longer have much of which to be proud." "I demand to see the American ambassador," said the girl huskily, still watching the pistol. "I am an American citizen. I demand the protection." Peter interrupted her again, speaking quickly. "This is not revenge. I'm old and wise enough to know that revenge has the most bitter taste of all human excesses. You cannot do it." The girl's voice rose, the same strident tones, but now shriller still with fear. "They will destroy you." But Peter went on, as though she had not spoken. "It is not revenge," he repeated. "You yourself gave the reason clearly. If you continue to exist, they will come to get you back. As long as you live, others must die, and they will die stripped of all human dignity. They will die in terror, the same way you murdered." "I'm a woman. I'm wounded. I'm a prisoner of war," screamed the girl, trying to struggle upright. "Those are the old rules," Peter told her. "You tore up the book and wrote a new one. I'm playing to your rules now. I have been reduced to your level." "You cannot kill me." The girl's voice rang wildly. "I still have work." "Colin," Peter said quietly, without looking at the American, "you'd better get out now." Colin Noble hesitated, his right hand on the butt of the Browning, and the girl rolled her head towards him imploringly. "You can't let him do it." "Peter," Colin said. "You were right, Colin," Peter spoke quietly. "That kid did look a lot like Melissa Jane." Colin Noble dropped his hand from the pistol and turned to the door. Now the girl was shrieking obscenity and threat, her voice incoherent with terror and hatred. Colin closed the door softly and stood with his back to it. The single crash of shot was shockingly loud, and the stream of filthy abuse was cut off abruptly. The silence was even more appalling than the harrowing sounds which had preceded it. Colin did not move. He waited 4-5 seconds before the door clicked open, and General Peter Stride came out into the main office. He handed the shot pistol to Colin, and one barrel was hot in his hand. Peter's handsome aristocratic features seemed ravaged, as though by a long wasting disease, the face of a man who had leapt into the abyss. Peter Stride left the glass door open and walked away without looking back. Despite the terrible expression of despair, he still carried himself like a soldier, and his tread was firm. Colin Noble did not even look through the open door. "All right," he called to the doctor. "She's all yours now." And he followed Peter Stride down the broad staircase. There was a long, hard gallop over good going and open pasture to the crest of the ridge, with only one gate. Melissa Jane led on her bay filly, her Christmas gift from Uncle Stephen. She was in the midst of the passionate love affair that most pubescent girls have with horses, and she looked truly good astride the glistening thoroughbred. The cold struck high colour into her cheeks, and the braid of honey-coloured hair thumped gaily down her back at each stride. She had blossomed, even in the few weeks since last Peter had seen her, and he realized with some awe and considerable pride that she was fast becoming a great beauty. Peter was up on one of Stephen's hunters, a big, rangy animal with the strength to carry his weight, but the gelding was slogging hard to hold the flying pair that danced ahead of him. At the hedge, Melissa Jane scorned the gate, gathered the filly with fine, strong hands, and took her up and over. Her little round bottom lifted out of the saddle as she leaned into the jump, and clods of black earth flew from the filly's hooves. As soon as she was over, she swiveled in the saddle to watch him, and Peter realized that he was under challenge. The hedge immediately appeared to be head high, and he noticed for the first time how the ground fell away at a steep angle beyond. He hadn't ridden for almost 2 years, and it was the first time he'd been up on this gelding. But the horse went for the jump gamely, and they brushed the top of the hedge, landed awkwardly, stumbled with Peter up on his neck for an appalling instant of time, in which he was convinced he was to take a toss in front of his daughter's critical eye, caught his balance, held the gelding's head up, and they came away, still together. "Superstar!" Melissa Jane shouted, laughing. And by the time he caught her, she had dismounted under the yew tree at the crest, and was waiting for him, with her breath steaming in the crisp, calm air. "Our land once went right as far as the church." Peter pointed to the distant grey needle of stone that pricked the belly of the sky. "And there, almost to the top of the downs." He turned to point in the opposite direction. "Yes." Melissa Jane slipped her arm through his as they stood close together under the yew. "The family had to sell it when Grandfather died, you told me, and that's right too. One family shouldn't own so much." Peter glanced down at her, startled. "My God, a communist in the family, an asp in the bosom." She squeezed his arm. "Don't worry, Daddy, darling. It's Uncle Stephen who's the bloated plutocrat. You're not a capitalist. You aren't even employed anymore." And the instant she'd said it, her laughter collapsed around her, and she looked stricken. "Oh, I didn't mean that. I truly didn't." It was almost a month now since Peter's resignation had been accepted by the War Office, but the scandal had not yet run out of steam. The first heady paeans of praise for the success of Thor's Delta strike had lasted only a few days. The glowing editorials, the full front pages, the lead news item on every television channel, the effusive messages of congratulations from the leaders of the Western governments, the impromptu triumph for Peter Stride and his little band of heroes, had quickly struck an odd note, a sudden souring of the ecstasies. The racist government of South Africa had actually agreed to the release of political prisoners before the assault. One of the hijackers had been taken alive and had died of gunshot wounds received in the terminal buildings. Then one of the released hostages, a freelance journalist who had been covering the medical convention in Mauritius and was returning aboard the hijacked aircraft, published a sensational eyewitness account of the entire episode, and dozen other passengers supported his claims that there had been screams from the fourth hijacker, screams for mercy, before she was shot to death after her capture. A storm of condemnation and vilification from the extreme left of the British Labour government had swept through the Westminster Parliament and had been echoed by the Democrats in the American Congress. The very existence of the Thor Command had come under scrutiny and been condemned in extravagant terms. The Communist parties of France and Italy had marched, and the detonation of an M-26 hand grenade, one of those stolen by the Baader-Meinhof gang from the American base in Metz. Amongst the crowd leaving the Parc des Princes football stadium in Paris, had killed one and injured 23. A telephone call to the offices of François, by a man speaking accented French, claimed that this fresh atrocity was revenge for the murder of four hijackers by the imperialist execution squad. Pressure for Peter's discharge had come initially from the Pentagon, and there was very little doubt that Dr. Kingston Parker was the accuser, though, as head of Atlas, he was never identified, total secrecy still surrounding the project. The media had begun to demand an investigation of all the circumstances surrounding Thor. And if it is ascertained that criminal irregularities did indeed exist in the conduct of the operation, that the person or persons responsible be brought to trial, either by a military tribunal or the civil courts. Fortunately, the media had not yet unravelled the full scope of Atlas Command. Only Thor was under scrutiny. They did not yet suspect the existence of either Mercury or Diana. Within the War Office and the governments of both America and Britain, there had been much sympathy and support for Peter Stride, but he had made it easier for his friends and for himself by tendering his resignation. The resignation had been accepted, but still the left was clamouring for more. They wanted blood. Peter Stride's blood. Now Melissa Jane's huge pansy-violet eyes flooded with the tears of mortification.
I didn't mean that. I truly didn't.
One thing about being out of a job, I have more time to be with my favourite girl. He smiled down at her, but she would not be mollified.
I don't believe the horrible things they're saying. I know you're a man of honour, Daddy.
Thank you. And he felt the ache of it, the guilt and the sorrow. They were silent a little longer, still standing close together. And Peter spoke first. "You're going to be a paleontologist," he said.
"No, that was last month. I've changed my mind. I'm not interested in old bones anymore. Now I'm going to be a doctor, a child specialist."
"That's good." Peter nodded gravely. "But let's go back to old bones for a moment. The age of the great reptiles, the dinosaurs. Why did they fade into extinction?"
"They could not adapt to a changing environment."
Melissa Jane had the answer promptly. Peter murmured, "A concept like honour, is it outdated in today's world, I wonder?" Then he saw the puzzlement, the hurt in her eyes, and he knew they had wandered into dangerous ground. His daughter had a burning love for all living things, particularly human beings. Despite her age, she had a developed political and social conscience, distinguished by total belief in shining ideals and the essential beauty and goodness of mankind. There would be time in the years ahead for the agony of disillusion. The term man or woman of honour was Melissa Jane's ultimate accolade. No matter that it could be applied to any of her current heroes or heroines, the Prince of Wales or the singer of popular songs with an outrageous name that Peter could never remember, to Virginia Wade, the former Wimbledon champion, or to the fifth form science teacher at Rodine, who had aroused Melissa Jane's interest in medicine. Peter knew that he should feel proper gratitude for being included in this exalted company. "I will try to live up to your opinion of me." He stooped and kissed her, surprised at the strength of his love for this child woman. "And now it's too cold to stand here any longer, and Pat will never forgive us if we're late for lunch." They clattered over the stone cobbles of the stable yard, riding knee to knee, and before he dismounted, Peter indulged himself in the pleasure of his favourite view of the house that had always been home, even though it belonged now, together with the title, to Stephen, the older brother, older by 3 hours only, but older nonetheless. The house was red brick, with a roof that ran at 50 different unlikely angles. It missed being hideous by a subtle margin and achieved a fairy tale enchantment. Peter could never grudge it to Stephen, who loved the sprawling edifice with something close to passion. Perhaps the desire to own the house and to restore it to its former magnificence was the goad which had pricked Stephen to the superhuman effort that a British resident must make against taxation and socialist restrictions in order to amass anything like a fortune. Stephen had made that effort, and now Abbott's Yew stood immaculate and well-loved in glorious gardens, and Sir Stephen kept baronial style.